short one. We'll take an at ease until the members get back in the room. Call the meeting to order. Welcome back to the Special Committee on Oil and Gas. Today is June the 5th, 2006. It's now 9:25 a.m. and we're convening the scheduled meeting for June the 5th. Members present in the room at this time are Senator Stebman, Senator Stevens, Senator Wilkins, Senator Bundy, Senator Wagner, myself, Senator Green, he's in sight. Also have in the audience, and the chair welcomes, and Senator Terrio and Senator Gary Stevens. Are there any other members present? Not seeing any. Before we look at Amendment 1B, Senator Wagner.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to withdraw the balance of Amendment 10, items B through Q.
Senator Wagner has withdrawn the remainder of Amendment number 10. And I'd like to invite Luann to come back up for just one moment. Luann, just for purposes of discussion, because I think we're going to look at some of these issues again in under the AK pipe bill. You heard some of our discussion and some of the questions having to do with separation of powers earlier, did you?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have moved too quickly over that in my own comments.
Since it's a new meeting, I'd like to ask you to reintroduce yourself, even though we know who you are.
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Louisiana Cutler. I'm a partner at Preston Gates & Ellis in Anchorage, Alaska.
Go ahead.
I think you heard Mr. Bailey essentially reiterate what I said with respect to the separation of powers problem. However, I think there's a qualitative difference in our view of the matter. We believe that the separation of powers problem is much more acute with respect to approval of collateral agreements, because although it definitely exists as well with respect to the fiscal contract itself, with respect to the taxing power, you have, of course, the Section 1 issue of Article 9 of the Constitution, which indicates that the legislature can contract away the tax power, although it can never surrender it. And then, of course, you have Section 4, which talks about how the power can be contracted away. So that's constitutionally provided for. And then in addition to that, you have the legal doctrine of unconstitutional delegation of the tax powers to begin with. Even if you weren't contracting it away for a while, there could still be an unconstitutional delegation if the legislature were not involved in that decision. So for those two reasons, we believe that the issue is more acute with respect to the fiscal contract, less acute, I should say, with respect to the fiscal contract itself, because again, the legislature has those two articulated powers with respect to taxing. When you're talking about the collateral agreements, yes, there probably would not be an LLC agreement to begin with if Alaska was not going to take a share in the pipeline, but it's not directly connected to the tax power. Instead, it's more akin to, again, a much bigger project here, but much more akin to the other kinds of contracts that public corporations and the administration enter into frequently without your approval of the exact language in the contract, as opposed to providing the authorization through statute to actually go ahead and enter into contracts. So we believe that with respect to the collateral agreements, the separation of powers problem is worse. And I just wanted to get that on the record because I'm not sure that that was clearly debated, the difference between our points of view. And again, I just would underscore that even Mr. Bailey recognizes that there is a problem. Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
No, I'm not a lawyer, Mr. Chairman, so a little slow on this. So my interpretation is that we've got Ledge Legal Counsel telling us that this is unconstitutional.
Hey, Sue.
We have legal advice from the administration telling us it's unconstitutional, yet we go ahead and adopt this amendment? Is that what's going on here today?
Could very well be. I will tell you that that's an unanswered question from the amount of time, Senator Stedman, that the Judiciary Committee put into the process, and this does raise another level in. And I also am not an attorney, but we spent a great deal of time in research on the underlying question in the Judiciary Committee having to do with the fiscal contract and the legislature's requirement of the law that it be the final approver, because in normal circumstances, the process would have been for the commissioner, after publishing his final findings of financial interest and his determination, at that point, they would have been allowed to, under normal circumstances, execute the contract. And in the amendments to the in 98 amendments, the state basically, at the suggestion of the then sitting governor, said we want to be the final approver of the contract. So you can't execute it until the legislature has approved it. That gave rise to a constitutional issue that Senator Terrio brought to the Judiciary Committee, in that we're departing from the norm, we are interjecting the legislature into what is normally an administrative process, and there could be constitutional issues. Here, what we're doing, it appears to me, is we're interjecting ourselves into the process of a collateral or a corporation, PIPECO, and saying that the board of directors of PIPECO cannot approve a collateral agreement until the legislature has authorized it, I believe. Maybe I'm wrong in that sequence, but it appears to me that's the sequence. Or the commissioner in the first 180 days.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
I recognize that the rest of the amendments have been pulled, but I do have some concerns of what these amendments were, and where they came from, and if the consultants that we've hired thought of these themselves. And in the process of this illustrative legislative amendment that was created, wrote those down in brainstorming fashion, or if they were spoon-fed to them. There's some in here that I look at as poison pills, clear and simple. And it's unfortunate that we're not going to have the opportunity to go by them one by one and flesh these out.
I think we'll have that opportunity under 2003 to look at some of these amendments. And certainly we'll have the opportunity to question some of the members of the consultants. Senator Bundy?
On this subject, as you and I have talked, the whole idea of even the legislature approving a basic gas pipeline contract is likely to be a subject of a court suit under the separations of powers issue. So this amendment puts us no more in jeopardy than the whole notion that we will reconvene later this summer and vote yes or no on a pipeline contract. We have dueling attorneys at this point. And dueling consultants. It comes down to gut check time and policy decisions. We have competing facts.
And I think, Senator Bundy, that we, that's part of the reason that 2001 was passed earlier by this body, was to say if there are constitutional questions that needed to be decided by the court, that the jurisdiction will be by original jurisdiction to the state Supreme Court, and that they have to be brought within 120 days after of the execution of the contract, to, so that we can answer those constitutional questions early in the lifespan. And we anticipate that there probably will be some challenges on that issue, and maybe on this one as well. We need to do some housekeeping on Amendment Number 12, which was Senator Hoffman's bill amendment. And Amendment Number 12, just a moment. As you may recall, if you look at Amendment Number 12, it was to insert the words, including gas pipeline pricing that encourages further gas exploration. The drafters have indicated that to make that sentence consistent with what they believe the intent was, that after the word pipeline and before the word pricing, we should insert the word expansion. Senator Hoffman, do you agree with that?
Yes, I so move, Mr. Chairman.
So Senator Hoffman has moved to amend Amendment Number 12 to include after the word pipeline, expansion. So now the sentence would read, including gas pipeline pricing, that expansion pricing that encourages further gas exploration. Is there objection? Seeing none. Amendment Number 1 to Amendment Number 12 is adopted, and we will, I think we need to readopt the amended.
I think we need to rescind our action.
We need to rescind our action on Amendment 12 first, I guess. Is there a motion to rescind our action on Amendment Number 12?
I so move.
Senator Green has moved to rescind action. Is there objection? Hearing none, our action on Amendment Number 12 is rescinded. Senator Hoffman, do you want to introduce Amendment Number 12? In revised form?
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
So Senator Hoffman has reintroduced Amendment Number 12 to include the words, including gas pipeline expansion pricing that encourages further gas exploration. Is there objection? Hearing none. Revised Amendment Number 12 is approved. We now have before us, we've concluded our business on Amendment Number 10. Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could we move to a different, back to this bill,
2004?
If I could, I don't pretend to understand what all of these amendments that have now been dropped do. I can see what they are on face value. But I'm a bit concerned by the terminology poison pill. So I would expect that those that have brought these forward would be prepared to defend them. So, Senator Stedman, would you be good enough to share with us those that you think are the? We don't have to discuss them right now, but it would certainly help, I think, those that will be asked to defend these, if you could just highlight those so that they could get to work on those that are most disturbing.
Well, Senator Wilken, I haven't taken the time to go down and mark which ones were, I thought were more egregious than the other ones, other than just highlight them all. So maybe at some point we can go through and deal with it. Right now I'm trying to dig it back out of my pile because I buried it. But I'm certainly willing to sit here and take the time while we got the room full of and go through each one of these individually and talk about them.
Senator Wilken?
We're not before us. We can't do that.
We are not really before us in terms of an amendment at this particular time.
And I'm not sure that's what I was asking. I was concerned about the poison pill statement. And if there are those that are really egregious, then we need to address those forthwith. But we can do that at a future time. I mean, we don't need to march down there. But if there's things in here that are going to show up tomorrow or next month, I'd sure like to know about them right now and have, while we have the people in the building that can address them in person, I'd certainly like to do that.
Okay, Mr. Senator Stedman, if you could maybe develop some of that. Senator Stevens?
Mr. Chairman, I'll highlight the one that, that shows me that it's a poison pill for success. And that's on page 3, starting at line 8 and 10. It says, the operating agreement must provide that the entity may not affect a material change of the quality project plan without review and authorization of the legislature. So that means that the legislature has to approve every material or amendment in the qualified project plan. That document has been worked on, I believe, we could say beginning with the document that was funded with the $125 million by the three sponsored groups back in 2000. To me, that is a poison pill, number one, because it's a limitation for success. It says that we cannot, that project cannot go forward without the legislative authorization of any change or amendment to a qualified project plan. And I believe that the people that are will be the team leaders in the qualified project plan are the experts, the engineers, the financial members that will build the line, and that is not what we do for, that is not our capacity. And that is, to me, the number one piece in that second portion of that amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Number 16 was another one that I flagged. That specifies the capital structure. The operating agreement must, the operative word, provide that the project entity shall, another operative word, use project financing supported by the federal guarantee instruments as defined in the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Act to the maximum extent available from the United States Treasury, and must limit the equity portion of the project capitalization to not more than 20% of total capital. I read that as we're going to specify and control how the other members are going to have their capital structure within this LLC.
Senator Wagner.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I withdrew these amendments because of the press of time and think we want to get through with business. But if it's the wish of the body to continue to go through these amendments, then let's bring them back before us and go through them one at a time.
Well, let's go on with amendment number 11.
We're discussing something that isn't even on the table in front of us.
Let's go on to amendment number 11, and we'll talk about these later. Senator Wagner, or Senator Dyson, your name is on amendment number 11.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have revised language that I think should be distributed, and it would be amendment number 13, and I will withdraw 11.
Amendment number 11 has been withdrawn.
In its place, offer 13.
And amendment number 13 is being distributed to the members at the present time.
And this is something that I personally don't know a lot about, but I'd like to ask Mr. Shepler and whoever else to come to the table and explain the reason why it's of value.
Mr. Shepler, welcome back to the committee. We'll get you a copy of the amendment, and if once again you and Mr. Barnes will introduce yourselves for the record, since we're in a new day.
Yes, sir. I'm Don Shepler. I'm attorney with Greenberg Traurig in Washington, D.C. Office. And Jim?
I'm James Barnes, a partner with Barnes and Cassio.
Okay. Senator Dyson?
Thank you. Would you all explain to us why
have you moved the amendment?
I thought I already did.
Okay. The amendment has been moved by Senator Dyson. I'm sorry, Senator Dyson.
Yeah.
I want to make sure it's on the record.
Yeah. Would you gentlemen please explain to us why this amendment is valuable and why we should do it?
Okay. In essence, the state, in looking at this fiscal contract, is being asked to make a current decision with regard to the nature of its investment. This reference to documents related to ownership, governance, management, control, and operation of the project, if the state is going to be making its firm decision at this point in time, these are matters that a board of directors would typically want to see and be included in the decision. The commitment, it admittedly, is going to be difficult to do all of those at this point in time. But the state's obligation or its commitment is at this point in time. And so I think the intent behind this amendment would be to give the state the opportunity to look at the full picture of the investment that it's being asked to commit to. I should also note that you contrast this with the decision point for the parties that are involved in the project sanction, which may be 4 or 5 years hence. By that point in time, much of this information will be obtained, and they can make their decision based on the additional information. But the same is not necessarily true for the state at the point where it considers the fiscal contract.
Okay, Senator Bundy.
Thank you. Initially, I would say this probably, being the governor's involved, perhaps this reduces some of the division of powers questions, but requiring the commissioner to submit to the governor all these documents when the commissioner works for the governor, don't we presuppose that the commissioner or that the governor has access to all this information, or is between the lines saying that the commissioners do not have access to all this information?
Senator, speaking for myself, and I would ask, I believe Mr. Gildon is still on the line. I know I personally was not involved in the drafting of this amendment.
Mr. Gildon, are you still with us, sir?
Yes, I am.
Did you hear Senator Bundy's question?
I did, but I don't know the context because I don't have a copy of the amendment that you're now considering.
Could we possibly could I get a copy of this fax to Mr.
Gildon? Yes, let's just take a short recess to get the copy of this fax to Mr. Gildon. Senator Dyson has brought before us Amendment Number 11. The chair, number 13, I'm sorry. Number 13. And the chair would entertain a motion to divide the question into two questions. One being the question proposed on page 2, lines 17, 18, and 19 from the remainder of the amendment. Senator Dyson?
16, yeah, 17. So moved.
Okay. Is there objection here?
I don't object. Could you just restate the line?
I think it's 16 through 18.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Maybe I have an old
version.
Line 16 through 18, you're correct. I had the wrong version in front of me. Yep, line 16 through 18 into one question, and the second question being the remainder of the document. So, let's talk about the first question, which we will now make 13A, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you.
That's on line 16 through 18.
Yeah. So I'm doing this as a courtesy to other members of the body, and I'll let them explain, maybe perhaps Senator Theriault and his consultants.
Senator Theriault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And my apologies. I was didn't understand that as a non-member to this committee that I could introduce an amendment, so I did ask Senator Dyson to put this in. The section that is before you right now is the suggestion to expand the public comment period. As you know, Mr. Chairman, it was an issue that was dealt with in the Senate Judiciary Committee during the regular session as part of Senate Bill 316. At that time, I did run an amendment to before the committee suggesting that due to the complexity of the overall package that's before us, that I thought that it would be beneficial to have additional time for the legislators, the general public, and members of other oil and gas companies in the state of Alaska have a little bit more time to understand the full contract and to submit input to the administration during the public comment period. Now, the current law, as you can see, says that it shall be at least 30 days. Early in the session, I know there was a healthy debate in the administration on whether the public comment should be at least 30 days or whether it should go up to 90 days. And of course, we know that the governor has stated that it's his intent to run at least a 45-day public comment period. Back when we were discussing Senate Bill 316, I had heard from some of the smaller players that their in-house counsel were really scrambling to try and understand the full impact of the contract so that they could put meaningful public input in during the public comment period. And so that's why I originally had suggested the 90 days. Now, in Judiciary, we did have testimony from the administration. I believe it was Mr. Kevin Jardell who indicated to the committee at that time that going up to 60 days was acceptable, but they thought that 90 days was a little bit too long. In having this drafted, I stuck with my original concept of 90 days. However, if it is the will of the committee to roll back to the number that the administration had indicated was acceptable at that time, certainly that it's up to your prerogative to do that. But I do believe not only for the general public, for legislators who have now started to think about how is it that I actually put comment in during the public comment period for consideration. How do I do that? How does that come together? And then also, very importantly, I think for the smaller companies, or not all smaller companies, but the non-producers, Shell, Anadarko, Pioneer, all of them, for their in-house counsel to have time to put meaningful comment in during the public comment period. If, in fact, you modified the language to 60 days, we'd be adding on basically 2 weeks to the suggested public comment period that the administration has running now.
Excuse me.
Senator Dyson?
Combination, maybe, but I repeat the last two sentences again, please. What you were just saying.
Well, I have put in 90 days in Judiciary. It was modified down to 60. The administration has indicated they're running sort of a 45-day public comment period. If this committee chose to go back to 60, it's the difference between 45 and 60, so it's basically an additional 2 weeks, which I think could be very critical for not only legislators making comment, but the other producers in the state of Alaska who are concerned about open access provisions, things of that nature, for them to have time to put meaningful comment into the process, too.
And if I may follow up then, so is it your view, Senator, that 45 days is really not adequate, and 60 gets to what's probably makes it?
Well, Senator, when I originally introduced the amendment to the Judiciary Committee, it was based on comments that I had from individual smaller companies who said they were really scrambling and that they thought the minimum amount of time that they would need would be 60 days. They said somewhere between 60 and 90 days if you wanted meaningful comment from them. And some of these operations are fairly small. We get used to talking about the producers and them having floors of lawyers in different office towers. And of course, companies like Pioneer or Anadarko certainly is a more sizable company. They have limited access. They don't have necessarily in-house counsel. They're dealing with hired counsel that needs to get up to speed, make their recommendations to the company, and then the company makes their recommendation through the public comment period. So if we want that to be meaningful, the suggestion to me was that they would need anywhere from 60 to 90 days in order to make that meaningful comment.
Senator Stevens, then Senator Elton. Oh, okay, Senator Stevens.
Well, in point of order, Mr. Chairman, I believe we're discussing the components of 13B, and the force is 13A.
Okay, we can make it B or A.
First point. Yeah. And under 13A, Mr. Terrio, I see the notice, the change between Section 3 on the original amendment and the section of the new proposed Amendment 11, removed from the language is all documents relating to all documents reasonably related to ownership, governance, and management. Now it says all documents related to ownership, government, management, control, and operation of the project. Again, I'm going to make the statement I made under the discussion of the previous amendment that the expectation that all documents over the operation of the project be completed prior within the next either 45 or 90 days is an unreasonable expectation. And that I don't believe that qualified project plan will be complete, because even under that assumption, it would say that the operation of the project would be complete and that would be filed to FERC. If that portion of operation of the project remains, is part of the requirement before the contract can be presented to us, we might as well just delay determination of this until a FERC qualified plan and a certificate of public convenience is issued, because that it will never, at least in my interpretation, will never be satisfied.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Terrio,
do you want to deal with the?
Let's deal with 13. We'll renumber it. 13A is the other. 13B is 16 through 18. Let's deal with 13B, and then we'll get into 13A. That's fine. I mean, I think that needs to be discussed. Probably much more at length than 13B. So if you don't object, Senator Stevens, let's dispose of 13B, which is lines 16 through 18. Then we'll get into that.
In that instance, then, if under the discussion of 13B, as written in the amendment now, at 90 days, today I believe is day 27 on the clock that's ticking for public comment, so that would be 63 days remaining. And under the calendar, Mr. Chairman, that would mean that we would not be able to accept the contract in the legislature not before August the 7th. And if we go to 60 days, we would not be able to accept it. That would be 4 weeks and 5 days from today. So that's 1, 2, 3, 4. It would be July the 8th, or the week beginning more than likely July the 10th.
Senator Bundy?
Adding to that timeline, Mr. Chairman, I think the administration has 2 weeks after public comments over.
So 30 days.
They have 30 days,
yes.
So assuming they would move along judiciously, you could figure a couple of weeks anyway after public comment before we would be expected to see the contract.
So we would see it, if they took the full 30 days, we would see it on August the 7th. If they didn't, the time clock on that would begin July the 8th. If Senator Stevens is correct, and I have no reason to believe he's not. So Otherwise, we would see it on approximately the third week of June at the current 45 days that the governor has said. The governor's quote, if I believe, is minimum of 45 days and whatever it takes in terms of time. Senator Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, the difficulty with that, of course, is the companies don't know whether they should be scrambling right now because the 45th day, that's going to be it. So I think, again, the suggestion to me was that for them to really have meaningful comment in the public comment period, they needed 60 to 90. You know, I've erred on the side for introduction of the amendment on maximum time. The debate that we had in judiciary was that that 90 was too much for the administration, 60 was acceptable. It would mean, as Senator Stevens indicated, that it would close on July 8th. It's a difference of roughly two additional weeks for the companies to try and pull together their public comment to express their concern on things like access to the pipe so that they can explore their acreage, things of that nature.
We have Mr. Leffler online for Senator Stevens. Go ahead first.
Just again, under 4382.430, the findings and determination, and it says under Section A, within 30 days after the close of public comment,
correct,
the Commissioner of Revenue shall provide the findings available to the legislature. So it closes, and then there's up to 30 days.
Up to 30 days, correct. He can do it quicker, but he has a maximum of 30 days. Mr. Leffler is online representing the administration. Do you have a comment, Mr. Leffler?
I don't know anything more than I think has been said publicly that I really don't. The resident representatives of the administration are in the room, I don't have anything to add.
Mr. DeWitt, do you have anyone that would like to speak to that, this issue?
Yes, we have Mr. Donahue and Mr. Ostrowski.
Mr. O'Donohue and Mr. Ostrowski, could you please come up? Mr. Donahue and Mr. Ostrowski. I got an O in front of O'Donohue there.
Or you could change Ostrowski to Strom.
Ostrowski and O'Donohue, yes.
Thanks,
if you gentlemen would, once again, since we're in a new day, introduce yourself to the record.
My name is Larry Ostrowski. I'm an attorney with the Oil, Gas, and Mining section of the Department of Law. With me is Joe Donahue, who is one of our contract counsel with the law firm of Preston, Gates, and Ellis. Mr. Chairman, that's correct. I believe the administration would agree with 60 days. It would be an acceptable period of time.
Okay. Further discussion? Are we ready for the question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman.
The amendment to the question, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I move that we amend the the numeric in line 16 to be 60 days instead of 90.
Senator Dyson has moved amendment number 1 to amendment 13B to insert 60 days in place of 90. Is there objection? Seeing none, amendment number 1 to amendment 13B is adopted. We're back to the original motion on 13B. Is there objection to 13B as amended?
Object.
Senator Stevens has objected. Madam Clerk, please call the roll.
Senator Stedman.
No.
Senator Bundy.
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Yes.
Senator Kukesh.
Yes.
Senator Stevens.
No.
Senator Dyson.
Yes. Yes.
Senator Elton.
Yes.
Senator Hoffman.
Yes.
Senator Green.
No.
Senator Wagner.
Yes.
Senator Secretary.
Vote no.
9 yeas, 3 nays.
4.
4 nays.
Oh, 4 nays. 4.
And so Amendment 13B passes.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, I move to table Senate Bill 2004 to no sooner than the week of July 10th.
Motion has been made to table Senate Bill 2004 till no sooner than the week of July 10th. Motion to table is not debatable.
Is a question of the bill sponsor allowed?
A question of the bill sponsor?
Or the amendment sponsor?
I will, the amendment to the bill or the bill sponsor?
The tabling.
Yes, I will allow you to ask it's not debatable, but I'll ask questions.
Why that date?
Because that equals the time that it was just adopted, 60 days, so no sooner than 60 days. 60 days from the point of public comment.
I understand. Thank you.
That equals the 4.5. That equals the additional 33 days that would be added to the public comment period.
So the amendment, the effect of the motion would be to table this bill until the 60-day comment period, which would not be a 60-day comment period. It would now be a 30-day comment period. If 2004 is not adopted, it would be 30 days from the date of May the 10th that the commissioner would be required to bring the final contract back, or the final version of the contract. That's the effect, so that you understand what the effect is.
Not May 10th, July 10th.
Actually, this would be July 10th, but if we do that, then the commissioner is compelled under current law to bring the final version back to us. He can bring it back to us anytime after 30 days from May the 10th. So there is no extension of time. The current law is in effect, and it's at the discretion of the governor, who has stated 45 days or whatever it takes. So, in effect, any time after that 45-day commitment, the governor can bring the contract back to us in its
question.
Final form. That's the effect, if I understand. So, with that in mind, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Undebatable.
Senator Stevens' motion.
Undebatable.
Undebatable.
Table.
Table the bill?
2004, correct, the bill, 2004, until, date certain, no earlier than July the 10th, 2006. Correct, Senator Stevens?
That's correct.
Not debatable. The clerk will call the roll.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Kukesh?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Stedman?
Yes.
Senator Dyson?
No.
Senator Wilkin?
No.
Senator Elton?
No.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Green?
Yes.
Senator Wagner?
No.
Senator Seekins?
No. Table to motion passes. This bill is set aside.
No, I'd like to change my vote.
Senator Bundy changes his vote to a... from yea to nay. The motion
is 6-6.
It fails in its current form. We'll take a short at ease. call the Special Committee on Natural Gas Development back to order. We have before us someone indicated that they wanted to revisit 10A. Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we rescind our action in having adopted 10A.
Senator Hoffman has moved to rescind our action in adopting Amendment 10A.
I've called the committee.
Senator Green has called the committee. We'll recess until the committee is present.
Mr. Chairman,
and we'll go ahead with, well, let's go ahead with the discussion.
Yeah, I'll object, and I'd like to ask a question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, yeah.
But we won't vote on that until after the entire committee is.
Yeah, so I'd enjoy Senator to explain why he wants to withdraw it and what the overall plan here is.
Well, you know, I think that the dialogue that we had earlier would suggest that we don't have oversight over major corporations such as the Alaska Permanent Fund, and by having it in this particular act would even cause further problems. Look at what we're doing at this table today. What are the majors going to be thinking about that? And I just think it's bad policy.
Mr. Jardel, you have an opinion on the motion to rescind 10A?
Thank you.
You introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kevin Jardel, Legislative Director for Frank Murkowski. The administration is strongly opposed to the amendment and supports the rescission of it. It's become very clear through the discussion and testimony, both in the Senate and the House, that members have quite a few questions about how the collateral agreements are going to be structured and what's in them, and are looking for answers. And I respect that, and we've discussed it. And throughout the Stranded Gas Act, it's clear that it's our burden as an administration to get those pieces of information to you and make sure that you're comfortable with what we have put together in this contract before you vote on that contract. And that's the burden that we have to carry, and we intend to do that throughout the education process until hopefully we get a ratification vote in the legislature. However, this particular amendment, I think, which is trying to achieve the same thing, getting the legislature to understand what's going to be in it, how it's going to be operated, has unintended consequences of what we believe killing any contract from going forward. The inability to have collateral agreements put together in a commercial way in the future, 2 years from now, 3 years from now, without coming back and having the legislature outside of those negotiations to make that commercial deal, change them, the uncertainty that goes along with that, we believe would not allow a commercial transaction or project like this to go forward. That being said, it's not just this project. We believe every application we have received, not just the producer's one, would require significant collateral agreements in the future, and this amendment forcing those to come back, we believe would be would make it unable to proceed on any application.
Okay, Senator Bunny, Senator Dyson, go ahead.
You can do me next.
I know that. Earlier discussions, six weeks ago, on this subject, some of our consultants had raised the question that the state was in such a weak position as a partner in this venture that the state, not the legislature, but the state, needed to have more control over the actions of it. And certainly many of us were interested in strengthening the state, as in the governor, the administration's position vis-a-vis the other partners of the agreement. Is the administration not interested in having a stronger position in those organizations than what is now, I guess, well, what we've now seen from the administration? You guys think you're strong in a strong enough position to protect the interests of people of Alaska?
Senator Dyson, we believe the contract does afford the state the protections necessary while achieving an outcome that is extremely beneficial to the state of Alaska. We think we fully comply with the purpose and the intent of the Stranded Gas Act, which was to go out and negotiate a deal to get the gas to market. We very much appreciate not only your comments, but the work that your consultants have done. We take those pieces of paper, we take the comments, and we send them to our team to analyze, to see what they're saying and see if they're right. It's part of the public process that's outlined in the legislative process outlined in the Stranded Gas Act. And we take those and we research them, and those that have merit, we intend to see if we need to renegotiate those pieces back into the final contract before we bring them to you. Those comments and that input is vital to making the Stranded Gas Act work and ensuring that we bring back a contract to the legislature that the legislature can support. But the difference is in setting it out in law where there is no flexibility to negotiate any part of it, or giving us that direction and that input and saying, we told you to go negotiate a deal under the Stranded Gas Act. We passed the law. We've put our input in through ourselves, the public, and consultants, and now go out and fix these parts or change these parts, and it's our job to try and go negotiate them. When you restrict our hand by actually writing out the language too restrictive, you really hinder the ability to comply with the Stranded Gas Act and negotiate the final deal.
Thank you.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I think we share a goal or a frustration of keeping the balances of power in balance, of being able to negotiate a commercial agreement balanced with the public's right to know via their legislators. And can I assume from what you've said that the administration will feel some obligation when they come back to give us enough information so that we would be comfortable approving a contract, that some version of a template of what LLCs would look like, so we have no desire to drill down to the point where we would be involved in every negotiated decision, but some idea so at the template level that we would have an idea of what the administration has in mind. And is that likely to occur?
Senator Bundy, we fully expect to get to members of the legislature an LLC agreement, other agreements that you can look at, the pattern agreements, frameworks. We intend to make sure that you have enough information to feel comfortable that the contract that we have agreed to is in the best interest of the state of Alaska and allow it to be ratified. So yes, we intend to get that information to you.
And Mr. Chairman, and so for the record, you're well aware that if there's a serious lack of information by 21 and 11 view of the legislature, the contract is not likely to pass.
Senator Bundy, we are very aware of the burden that we have and the responsibility to ensure that the decision by the legislature is an educated one and informed one. And so, yes, we do recognize that.
Thank you. if I might.
Go ahead, Senator Bundy.
We have a motion on the table. I'll ask my question at a more appropriate time.
Other questions for for Mr. Jardel? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the comments you made, Mr. Jardel, was that there were unintended consequences related to this, the passing of this amendment. Can you be more specific in what they are besides the collateral agreement and the interference and or inhibitions there are to go ahead and engage or even in, ratify those?
Senator Olson, I had said that I had hoped there had been unintended consequences because I believe what the legislators are trying to do is gather information and to comfort themselves that they will have that information and to ensure that they will be able to make an informed decision. I think that is what the intent of that amendment was, to ensure that you have that information before you vote on the contract. The unintended consequences of that were that it wasn't just about the information that would actually, in our opinion, kill the contract or other contracts because of the uncertainty in not knowing if you can do collateral agreements and get them signed off by the partners in the project in a timely fashion years from now without waiting for a session and going before the legislature to sign the collateral agreements. And so that was the consequences that I hoped were unintended, and that this was really about ensuring that the legislature was informed and aware of what we were doing.
So I guess what you're telling me is that legislative oversight, if the legislature is during the interim and is out of session, is going to delay some critical decisions that are going to be made?
Through the Senator Olson, I think that is one possibility that could be very problematic, mm-hmm. of not having the legislature in session to sign an agreement and delaying a commercial project. But there are many as far as just not allowing the partners to go forward, much like requiring any of the executive branch departments to bring back all the contracts that we do every day, be it DOT signing a contract for landing fees at an airport, or HFC doing a housing project, or ADA doing a loan. Decisions have to be made in a commercial operation to move forward in a timely manner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wagner.
The views you're expressing, are they your views, the administration's views, or the producer's views, or just whose views are you expressing in your testimony?
Senator Wagner, I express the views and represent the administration.
So these are not views that have been transmitted to you recently by the producers, that this would be a deal killer?
Through the chair, a little more informal. Senator Wagner, no. These are the views of the administration that we formed on our opinion of looking at them.
Thank you.
Other questions? Senator Elton.
Well, just a comment in response to something that Mr. Jardel has said. I mean, my understanding of what we tried to accomplish with the amendment is not that we were going to need to approve each and every contract that was done by PIPECO or any other entity. What this amendment was trying to do is to just say the legislature will approve the charter or the recipe under which the entity operates. And so I'm comfortable with that. I'm comfortable with the legislature saying here's the recipe and kind of blessing the recipe. I don't think anybody's suggestion is that any future contract is going to have to come back to the legislature for approval.
In effect, as I read the amendment, each collateral agreement would be a condition subsequent to the fiscal contract. Condition subsequent, tied back to the fiscal contract is pretty heavy. Senator, Mr. Jardel?
If I could just make a comment, Senator Elton, the administration believes that through the Stranded Gas Act process in the upcoming weeks and the information process, that you will be fully informed and aware of the administration and the producer's intent on what they are going to be signing and the patterns and the forms of that. If in the event we don't provide that information, then we could certainly have opportunities for the legislature to weigh in on that and let the administration know that we need to provide more information or have other tools available to you to ensure that we do.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The motion is to rescind our action, and then the motion, the original motion would be before us, and that would be the time to discuss the merits of that motion again.
Okay. We certainly can. We do have all the members. The call is satisfied, Senator Green. And we have a question, Senator Green.
Yeah, I'm wondering if it even matters now. I think this reads awkwardly, beginning with line 5, each collateral agreement shall be a condition subsequent to the proposed contract developed under this chapter shall be subject to review and authorization.
Probably should have been an and in there.
Mr. Chairman, I think we are discussing the
right
amendment.
Let's discuss whether, is there further discussion on the rescinding of our action to approve Amendment 10A? Hearing none, is there objection to rescinding our action on 10A? Senator Elton and Senator Wagner have objected. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Senator Stedman?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
I'll pass.
Senator Kukesh?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Dyson?
No.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Wilkin?
No.
Senator Elton?
No.
Senator Hoffman?
Yes.
Senator Green?
Yes.
Senator Wagner?
No.
Senator Seekins?
Yes.
ADA 4A.
Now before you, is there a motion to adopt?
The original motion is before us.
Original motion is before us now. We have rescinded our action. Further discussion on the original motion.
Senator Green had a
question.
No, I think you may be right. I think there's the word "and" has been omitted between chapter and shall. In this chapter and shall be subject to review and authorization. It reads awkwardly. Thank you. That's all.
Mr. Jardell, I've been in business for 36 plus years. And don't have any government partners. I've had many different associations with Ford Motor Company, with other organizations, and one of the things that I have found out is that good agreements make good partners. And when responsibilities and the duties and the powers of all the parties are well set out and that you tend not to have that many disagreements that end up in court. You'll still disagree as to policy from time to time, but you certainly have the methodology necessary to settle those agreements. And everybody knows where they are. And I think that's part of the question that I think you're accurately describing, is that it's very difficult for members of the body to be able to feel comfortable without seeing the template that would go along with this, with the LLC, and what might be evolve into further collateral agreements down the road. I think we as members want very badly to protect the interests of the folks that we represent, and to make sure that our relationship is with the producers in this very important and long-lasting agreement are agreements that we think are in the best interest of the people of the state and those that we represent. Particularly, I think about my grandchildren when I talk about this, because they're the true beneficiaries over the long run. Some of us don't have that many more years on this little blue ball. But, so it is of great concern that we look at this, and I think I appreciate the fact that the administration is willing to say, we will provide you with these templates. and that we will, and to make it very clear that you're not trying to hide the ball at this point. But with that in mind, we haven't seen this LLC, and we had some earlier testimony today, and I know you're not deeply immersed into the negotiations, but can you, in your opinion, give us a reason why it has been, it's taken longer than maybe some of us would anticipate for us to be able to see that template?
Senator Seekins, I would not care to characterize why or what the difficulties are, other than to say that I believe we're trying to make sure we get it right. I have not been that deeply involved with the actual negotiations of the LLC and would not feel comfortable commenting on that. We could provide somebody that may be able to.
Well, it's my opinion that it's four parties trying to come up with what's best for all four parties without stepping on the rights of the other parties, not them, those three against us as a state. Is that a fair characterization?
Senator Seekins, you've asked me to comment on your characterization. I think your characterization that it is certainly not three against one and that each one is negotiating with the other is accurate.
Okay. So we have further questions for, would any of the members like to ask any other of our other experts any questions on Amendment 10A? Senator Terrio, you're welcome to ask questions.
Mr. Chairman, just with regard to the...
Could you pull that microphone over there,
Senator? With regard to the discussion on the impact, there's a definition in the bill here that talks about the collateral agreements. Now, of course, I can't...
Right where you, where it was when I handed it to you.
Page 6.
On page 6 of 2004?
Yeah. There's a definition section here, isn't there? That talks about the collateral agreement under the definition section.
Page 7.
Page 7?
Line 14.
Line 14, page 7.
Includes agreements between either the state entities, qualified sponsor, to form limited liability companies. So I don't know other forms of business association. So the decisions that get made by, I wasn't sure from the discussion if it was that the legislature would have to then approve all these decisions made by these corporations. It appears to me that under the definition section, it's narrowed, that it would just be when the state in fact sets up the business or gets into the business operation, not that we're overseeing all the decisions of the business operation.
In a specific time frame, or is that in a continuum in time?
I think that's a continuum.
That's kind of my understanding as well. There may be additional, as we heard in Canada, it may not be an LLC, it may be a joint venture. In other states, depending on their corporate law, it may be an LLC or it may be a corporate other type of corporation. Am I correct in assuming that, Mr. Donahue?
Mr. Chair, I just want to reiterate that this is a transitional power, the collateral agreement power. It resides in the Commissioner of Revenue for 180 days after the effective date of the Authorization Act. That authority relates to agreements entered into by the state with potentially the affiliates and parents of the producers, which would really be a administrative contract which lines up those parties that are actually going to carry out the contract with the terms and conditions of the fiscal contract that's been approved. With regard to the limited liability agreements, the commissioner's power, which is really now both two commissioners. Once the board is, once the AK pipe legislation is enacted, the Commissioner of Revenue and the Commissioner of Transportation and Public Facilities would be able to act on behalf of the public corporation for up to 120 days. And thereafter, the public corporation would take full responsibility going forward for the negotiation and execution of any remaining LLC agreements. The as Mr. Jardel has just indicated, the administration will make every effort to have a template, and in fact, it's my understanding it's going to be more than a template. It would be the mainline LLC agreement that would be presented at the time the legislature has the opportunity to review the fiscal contract.
So it's your testimony that after this transition period, the restriction that would be put on under 10A would no longer be in effect for any future LLC that the committee, that the board of directors would enter into?
The proposed amendment 10A does read as a condition subsequent and would continue beyond this transition power.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Senator Elton.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To follow up on your question, if I understood the testimony of Mr. Donahue, I mean, the limitation of power is a limitation on the commissioner's ability to negotiate a collateral agreement, and his power to do that lapses 180 days after the effective date of the law authorizing the contract. So if I'm understanding correctly, really what we're talking about is the limitation in the amendment will probably only be applied to the mainline entity LLC. Is that correct?
Senator Elton, that is not correct. The condition subsequent would require all continuing obligation to bring those back before the legislature. And what the administration believes is the only commercial viable option is to give that public corporation the ability to enter into those agreements without having to come back each time to the legislature for approval.
Okay. Are there further questions? Seeing none, have before us Amendment 10A. Is there objection to adopting Amendment 10A?
Yes.
Objection has been stated. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Senator Stevens?
No.
Senator Kutesh?
No.
Senator Stedman?
No.
Senator Bundy?
No.
Senator Olson?
I'll pass.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Senator Wilkins?
Yes.
Senator Elton?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Yes.
No.
Senator Olson?
Yes, you know.
No.
Senator Green?
No.
Senator Wagner?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
No.
Four yeas and eight
nays. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Jardel, on the passage of Amendment 13B, I wonder if you might comment upon that.
13B.
Don't have the amendment before
the
me.
30 days to 60 days on comment, public comment period. Is that the number of days that you think is adequate and fair, or should it remain 30? Should it be at the 60 as was adopted? Or is 45 days the preference of the administration?
Senator Hoffman, the governor on a number of occasions has said that the process should be as long as is necessary to get adequate information out to the public, and more importantly, have adequate time to listen to the public and of course the legislature as well. The governor today will be announcing the third phase of the public process, where there will be a, without stepping on his announcement, where we will be going back to communities and having panel type discussions, more interaction, trying new and different ways to get the information out, so we provide as many different methods of getting the information to the public as we can. I believe the time that we will take will be, as the governor said, satisfactory to ensuring that people have an adequate time. We support leaving it as it is because it gives us the most flexibility to move as the current Stranded Gas Act is written, because I believe it gives us the most flexibility into ensuring that we complete that process, and the process can be completed when it's been when we've had an adequate amount of information back and forth.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. And, but the net practical effect is that public comment will likely not be completed before mid early July.
Senator Bundy, without a calendar in front of me, that sounds like the practical reality. I'd have to put it out, but it's hard to be definitive because I think the governor's commitment is genuine and real, that we will go as long as it takes to ensure that people have adequate time to comment and be informed.
And if I might, Mr. Jardel, the reason I ask is that the amendment we passed would extend public comment period to the 10th of July, and you said your best guess would be that public comment would likely go on to that approximate period anyway.
Through the chair, or not through the chair, otherwise. Senator Bundy, we continue to believe that leaving it as it is the best option, and just progressing through as time as is necessary to meet our obligation, our responsibility.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hoffman.
I move that we rescind our action in adopting 13B.
Jack.
And my arguments are that it says at least it still can go 60 days, 80 days, 100 days, but we can make those arguments if the motion is rescinded.
Motion has been made to rescind action on 13B. Is there a discussion, Senator Olson?
Mr. Chairman, just so I'm clear here, so we'd be moving the date from 60 days to 30 days?
No, we'd be keeping it at 30 days.
Keeping it at 30 days if we rescinded our action?
Correct.
So we would be going from 60 days to 30 days because the action was to get 60 days, correct?
Correct. I have no problem leaving the amendment the way it is, since it's the intent of the legislature. I mean, the governor is not objecting. The administration does not object.
Is that the testimony that we heard here today?
Is that
earlier?
Are you objecting?
Senator Seekins,
if that's the testimony, I will withdraw my motion.
We believe that the current Stranded Gas Act provides us the greatest flexibility.
Okay. All right.
The original.
The 30 days.
The original Stranded Gas Act, and with the governor's assertion and commitment to get the information out to the public, we believe that's sticking with the Stranded Gas Act as much as we can, the original one. We think that's the correct way to go.
Even though, as I understand it, the governor has said we will take at least 45 days.
The governor continues to say that he will take as much time as necessary.
All right. Senator Elton and then Senator Wilkin.
Just a question of Mr. Jardel. I mean, before we took our
break, it seems to me like 45 minutes or so ago, his testimony was that he didn't think there'd be an objection to 60 days. And if I understand his testimony now, he thinks that the current language at 30 days is correct. And maybe I misunderstood him earlier, but if not, I'd like to know what the change in position of the administration, what prompted the change in the position of the administration.
Senator Elton, I don't think I testified prior to the break, but we certainly had some discussions, and you know, again, the administration, I don't think we're changing our position. The governor has maintained from day one of the announcement that the time that it takes will be determined by when the people have an adequate time to get the information and respond to the information. And so that is the commitment of the administration, and we will meet that commitment. And that's our position. And I think we've been consistent with that position.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
My recollection is pretty much the same as Senator Elton's.
That I did testify.
Well, Senator. Okay. Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My actions will support the 60 days. It's really a moot point. Mr. Jell, thank you for bringing that. Thank you for bringing that information to us, and I appreciate going the extra mile to go back to the communities. So it's really a moot point, given what you've said, and I think that supporting the 60 days just gives one more indication to the people of Alaska, the people that I represent, that we're willing to take whatever time is needed. Thank you.
Senator, Mr. Jardel.
It has been pointed out that I believe someone else has testified today that we would not object to it, and has reminded me that before the Judiciary Committee on a different bill, at that time I testified that we would not object to it. And so just to be clear with the committee members.
With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll withdraw my motion.
Motion has been withdrawn by Senator Hoffman, Senator Elton.
Just to correct the record, I mean, I've been passed a note that refreshed my memory also. It was Assistant AG Larry Ostrowski that testified that he didn't think the administration would have a problem with 60 days.
Mr. Ostrowski or Ostrowski, whichever, however I pronounced it. Okay. Further comments? Senator Stevens?
Mr. Chairman, I would move we recess till 1 p.m.
Motion's made to recess. We will reconvene at 1 p.m. Special Committee on Natural Gas Development, come back to order. For the matter of the record, the call was satisfied and lifted prior to the recess. The next thing we're going to move into, we did get a chart that was distributed to members prior to the recess, and Mr. Barnes, maybe if you could explain what this chart is for the members.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. The chart is an attachment to a memo that I submitted like about a week ago or so. And in essence, it is a possible structure that I think is what is contemplated by the fiscal contract. And if you take a look at it, it's a general corporate structure with the parent entities up on the top row, and then you move down through subsidiary organizations. So for instance, under the state, the entities that are contemplated in this would be AK Pipeco, which we've heard about, and I think it's going to be set up pursuant to what is now Senate Bill 2003. We've not heard anything about
AK Gasco. And then the other Gascos are the marketing affiliates of the other producers. The entities that are actually engaged or prospectively engaged in the fiscal contract are the direct affiliates of BP, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and then the state, of course, is the entity that currently exists. It is a party to the fiscal contract. And then as you would look at this chart, you'll see that the various pipeline-owning affiliates, along with AK Pipeco, you would have a pipe-owning affiliate for each of the producers, and they would own portions of the LLCs. So, for instance, we've heard that the Alaska Project Entities, as they're called, would include an entity related to gas transmission, gas treatment, mainline, and possibly NGL extraction. Then in Canada, there would be other project entities. They wouldn't necessarily be LLCs, but you would need something to own an entity to own the pipe from the Alaska border to AECO, and perhaps from AECO to the U.S. border if the Chicago segment is contemplated. And also, there could be an NGL extraction facility at AECO. And then finally, if the move is made to move on to Chicago, I think the agreement is contemplates that there would be one or more entities dealing with the project from AECO to Chicago. And each of these apparently are going to be separate entities. So the sort of dashed line that I've drawn around these project entities is really just to indicate that with respect to each of those project entities, you'd expect to see some sort of governance in agreement to use one of the phrases that we coined here. Each of those project entities is its own silo, and you would expect to see some sort of governance agreements that describe how the members will interact with each other. For instance, how will AK Pipeco, EM Pipeco, CP Pipeco, and BP Pipeco, for instance, interact within their silo or within that project entity. In addition, those entities, each of those entities, they're all connected by the flowing gas, and there needs to be some sort of coordination as you move between them. There may also need to be some financing, and I think we've seen from the administration proposals that there is several bits of financing have been talked about, whether you use the federal loan guarantee or not, and whether some of them may use it or not, and whether it's done on equity or so on. But the point is, some sort of financing arrangement will need to be put in place among those. And then, you know, I think the SB 2003 actually sets up the governance arrangements for AK Pipeco. Now, if I can just turn for a moment to AK Gasco, this is the gas-owning entity. Now, whether it would be an actual arm of the state or a separate corporation, state corporation, we can't say at this point. It is called the state capacity holder under the fiscal contract, but it would have its own governance arrangements. It would be the holder of the capacity, so it would have the shipper pay commitment, and then how it handles that shipper pay commitment and whether it is guaranteed by the state or some other financing arrangement remains to be seen. And then finally, there's a dashed line around the BP, ConocoPhillips, ExxonMobil, and the state up at the top. And there needs to be some sort of, at least it seems to contemplate that there's going to be some sort of concerted action by these entities in arranging the regulatory approvals, both in Canada and Alaska, and then perhaps in the United States, and how that coordination is going to take place so that the full structure of these organizations work together. It seems like there should be some sort of undertaking coordination or and perhaps some guarantee arrangement. But it was those groupings of entities is what this chart was trying to indicate, is what the fiscal contract seems to contemplate and what we know and what we don't know at the present time.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Are there questions? Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barnes, could you help me with the significance of the solid lines versus the dotted lines? And I guess I'm looking at, let's just take ExxonMobil blue, that is a solid line down to ExxonMobil Gasco green. If we go over to the state, it's a dotted line down to Gasco. What's the significance of the difference?
Well, I believe that, for instance, BP and BP BP probably already has a gas marketing affiliate, and it's the colored boxes. I think just I was trying to indicate that those are entities that have already been established, and a solid line indicates that the relationship is known. In the case of AK Pipeco and AK Gasco, we have a legislation pending on Pipeco. As I said, there doesn't seem to be anything on Gasco, and it's in gray and with a solid line.
So it doesn't indicate control or things like that. It's just a matter of whether they're in place or not.
Yeah, that's all I was trying to indicate.
All right, thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Barnes? Thank you, Mr. Barnes, for clarifying that for us this afternoon. Returning to the business of Senate Bill 2004, we have been provided with an additional amendment. Senator Wilken.
Let's see if I'll be brief at ease.
Right. We'll take a short recess.
In place, just in ease.
And at ease.
Yes.
Short at ease.
Let's see.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to propose a conceptual amendment, if that's in order.
That's in order. Amendment number, we'll call it number 15.
Number 15.
For the clerks. Thank you, Robin.
Mr. Chairman, we've had substantial discussion and substantial input and testimony from various entities about Section 11 collateral agreements. It's my opinion that this section isn't ripe for action yet. We don't have enough information, and I would like to propose a conceptual amendment that Section 11 be deleted from 2004, and it can be addressed at a later date when it is ripe.
Senator Bundy has moved amendment number 15, which would delete Section 11 of 2004, which begins on page 6, line 20, and continues through page 7, line 19.
It's actually line 19 beginning.
It begins line 19, I'm sorry. You're right. Begins on page 6, line 19, and continues through page 19 page 7, line 19. Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd offer the sponsored a friendly addition, which on page 2, lines 27 through 29 also be deleted. It references collateral agreements.
I think that's the only other place I've heard reference.
Senator Bundy.
I would consider that a friendly amendment.
So, amendment 15 would eliminate the portion I referenced earlier and would also eliminate lines 27 through 29 on page 2 of 2004. Is there objection to this amendment? Seeing none, amendment 15 is adopted. Don't see Mr.
Not here yet.
Baldwin here yet. We'll take a short recess.
I can take a stab at it.
We can take a stab. Senator Wilken,
Is Steve Van Zandt online, sir? Steve Van Zandt's online. So,
yep. He is.
And Eddie's coming, and so is, but let me just move amendment number.
Number 14.
Thank you. Here it is. And object for discussion.
Senator Wilken has moved amendment number 14. Do all members have a copy? Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll do the best I can here. This is a result of, you know, in our foundation formula, we have a provision that it depends on basic need or 45% of your prior basic need. And that is, that's part of our foundation formula. Here's Eddie just in time to save me. What has happened because we're going to a throughput method evaluation rather than a full and true value, we're going to pull away the full and true value component in education funding. That affects any borough that uses any part of the 4356 to fund their schools, but particularly affects Valdez and North Slope because they use such a large amount. So there had to be some way to either fix this or just be ready for the state's basis to just backfill the amount of money. And I've got a spreadsheet here I didn't pass out to you because it's a little complicated and busy. But when you work through it, and Mr. Van Zandt developed it, but the fact of the matter is Fairbanks loses about 2%, Kenai loses 6%. Of their funding, North Slope 81%, Valdez 30%. So, this the mechanics of this amendment fixes this problem, and I would ask Mr. Jeans and Mr. Van Zandt to help us.
Mr. Jeans, let's give everybody an opportunity to have the copy of the spreadsheet in front of you. So we'll just pause for a second while everyone gets a copy.
Thanks.
I don't know if I did or not. Members have a copy. Mr. Jeans, if you would introduce yourself for the record, we're eager to hear your comments on this amendment. Pull that microphone right over in front of you there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Eddie Jeans. I'm the Director of School Finance for the Department of Education and Early Development. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilken did a really good job explaining what this amendment does. Annually, we get a report from Commerce and Economic Development from the State Assessor, Mr. Steve Van Zandt, that tells us what the full value determination is for each municipality in the state. And then we use that to calculate the required local contribution for each of those municipalities. So what this amendment will do is require the state assessor to continue, for the purposes of the Department of Education, to include the value of the oil and gas under 4356 in making that full value determination. So basically, Mr. Chairman, it keeps the program the way it currently is for calculating required local effort for public schools.
Okay, further comment? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I take it that with this amendment, it would then be treated as it is treated today, with one half of the assessed value over 1999. Included, or is it going to be treated differently and actually marked to the
through the chair? It would continue the way it currently is, Senator Stedman. What this does is tells the state assessor how to calculate the full value determination for a given year, and the 50% provision that you're referring to is in another section, so that was not affected.
And Ms. Jeans, we've relaxed the rules in the committee. You can answer directly to the senator. You don't have to answer to the chair. Senator Stedman, go ahead.
This is a quick follow-up. So the way it is presently today, the TAPS line is treated differently from other real estate in Anchorage and Juneau, and that it's assessed value using the calculations is at 100%, not at 1999 plus 1% of growth after 1999.
I can't help myself, through the chair to Senator Stedman. That piece of the equation is not changing. It's staying the same. And what this amendment here does is allow the state assessor to continue to calculate the full value determination as he always has. So what this does is preserve both parts of the foundation program for required local contribution in terms of how the state, how the full value is determined, and then secondly, how we apply it in the formula.
Okay.
Go ahead. I could get with you later because it doesn't really answer the question. I guess what I'm trying to get to is TAPS treated differently than other real estate? Real property.
I'm not sure I understand.
I think that's a question for Steve and Sam. I don't think either of us probably answer that question for you, Senator.
Okay. I'll get with them later, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Senator Wilken was next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just for the committee's information, the municipal advisory groups gave us a resolution 2006-03, issues related to effects of a stranded gas act contract on education funding, and the two resolves out of that is leads to this amendment.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. Other comments or questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Who do we have? Mr. Van Zandt?
This is Steve Van Zandt, State Assessor.
Mr. Van Zandt?
If I could I answer Mr. Sedman's question for him?
Sure can. Thank you for introducing yourself. Go right ahead, sir.
Senator Sedman, the answer to your question to Mr. Jeans is no, TAPS is not treated any different in assessment for any of these purposes than any other property. We include it in the full value. If it increases in value over the 99, it's still only 50% of that. So it's counted just like any other real property that goes on the assessment roll. So it's all treated the same. This amendment will just assure that the full value continues to contain the value for all oil and gas property. We'll have to come up with regulations on how we're going to do it. Basically, we'll do it just the same way as we are now. But instead of deleting the value from it, which makes a significant change for North Slope and Valdez, we'll include the value in there. Therefore, there'll be no revenue loss for either Valdez or North Slope. And just for the committee's information, the second page of that spreadsheet is actually the one that you should be interested in. The second page shows how many dollars are actually lost by the North Slope borough and the city of Valdez, and there's a percentage there too. But North Slope loses about $15.7 million, and City of Valdez almost $1 million in additional school funding if we do not include the value of oil and gas in the full and true value.
Does anybody object to that? Seeing no objection, Senator Olson? No.
Well, I think that the district that I represent, my people certainly would be incensed if this was not equilibrated in some way, and so I appreciate the effort.
I didn't think there'd be any objection to reducing the North Slope Borough's funding, but I guess I was wrong, Senator Olson. Thank you.
Oh, that's, you know, I'm yeah, fully behind my people.
the other questions for the gentleman. Jim, did you have a comment?
No, I agree that with everything that Mr. Jeans has said as to the effect of this amendment.
So we have a problem. This fixes the problem, correct?
That's correct. Correct.
Is there further objection to amendment number
14?
Seeing no objection, amendment number 14 is adopted. Let's take a short recess. Senator Theriault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. From the discussion this morning, I had asked the drafters to work on the 13A section, and I have not received anything back yet. The idea that I had, since you had expressed some concern over where we placed that requirement in the process and what had been suggested by the drafter that it would be replaced in the process that we're already well into, what I had asked him to do is recast that language, and if you look on page 1, lines 11 through 13, the language that I asked him to shrink that down to would read as follows: all documents related to the ownership, governance, management, control, and coordination of the project and participating entities, I was going to take that language and insert it where the underlined language is on line 20. So I was just going to put it into a process that information would be required at a point in the process that we hadn't reached yet.
Okay, so we...
But I have not got that back from the drafters.
And we just pulled out section 11 having to do with the collateral agreements.
This relates to section 11.
And so this relates to section 11 as I understand it.
That's right.
So at this point, we probably just let this lie on the table.
That would be okay. It seems like if we're going to get back to that collaborative process and there's some
right.
discussion with the administration on the need for the legislature to have details on those entities, that it could wait till that time.
That is our intent. So we will just not take any action on 13A. Okay? Those are the only two that were remaining outstanding that we have not taken any action on. Let's just go off the record for a moment. Come back to order, Senator Wagner.
I'm not going to offer an amendment at this time or anything, but tomorrow during the roundtable, I plan to have some discussion. On, if you look at lines 21 through 24,
page 2,
dealing with oil and gas lease agreements, unit agreements, and other agreements, I'm going to ask the consultants on both sides if they'd like to discuss the leases that are rolled into the contract, what that does to those leases, how it treats the current leases we have, and what the state stands to gain and what the state stands to lose. And with this amendment, we'd be putting quite a bit more authority, I think, into the commissioner's toolbox, and I think we need to really look at this real hard before we do that. So.
Thank you, Senator Wagner. Senator Wagner mentioned roundtable, so I saw some quizzical looks on people's faces. Let me tell you what the schedule is, tentative schedule. Tomorrow morning, we will convene at 9 a.m. for the purpose of questions and answers to the consultants that are here in town with us. On Wednesday, I believe we will have an early morning floor session on Wednesday, and shortly after that floor session, we'll convene in a roundtable discussion where we are inviting the administration, legislators, consultants, and producers to a roundtable discussion on matters pertaining to natural gas development. So it, I'm sure, will be a very stimulating conversation, and we'll try to keep it under control. But I think that that is our intent at this particular time, to be able to give members the opportunity to ask questions, particularly of the consultants that are here in town, and then later on the next day to have a roundtable discussion with producers, the administration, those consultants, and members of the legislature, so that everyone knows what our, and that is a kind of a liquid time frame. It will be shortly after our floor session in the morning that we'll convene that. All right, Senator Theriault. We have before you, it says amendment number 16, but I think that's 15. No, it is 16? Yes, that's right. It is 16. They're right. I'm wrong. As usual, those ladies on our right are right. The would you, we need a member to move the amendment.
Move amendment 16.
Object. Senator Wilkin has moved the amendment. Senator Theriault.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And fine. Of course, we've got the odd dynamic of discussing a bill whose likelihood of passage in this special session before the close of the special session is doubtful at best. But because this forum has been used to get ideas on the table, this is the one of the ones that, since the presentation of the contract and the meetings that we had down at Centennial Hall, has been a concern of mine. Of course, going back a couple of years ago, there was legislation pending before the legislature that proposed to limit the powers of the RCA, Regulatory Commission of Alaska, with regards to regulation on the oil pipeline. And now, of course, in the contract that's before us, there is a suggestion that we will rely on FERC to do the regulation of this monopoly transportation system. But yet, if FERC is, of course, a creation of the federal government, if we lock in for any lengthy period of time, we don't know down the road, 15, 20 years from now even, whether FERC continues to exist. And it's my understanding and the suggestion in the contract is that if FERC doesn't exist, then the only thing that would be there to regulate the monopoly transportation system would just be business agreements that the RCA, the entity that's a creation of the state of Alaska, would be precluded from stepping in if, in fact, FERC did not regulate. And it seems like a strange dynamic that we take comfort in the regulation of FERC to protect the consumer dealing with this monopoly, but then again, if, in fact, FERC ceases to exist, or for some reason there is a part of the operation that is not covered by FERC, we would preclude our own state entity from acting in that role again to act as a buffer between the monopoly operation and the consumer, and that we would just fall to business agreements. And I'm not sure why we would do that. So what this language would do would be to direct the administration that the contract is not to not increase FERC's or RCA's powers, but would not diminish them either, either the RCA or successor agency, if in fact the state changed the RCA sometime in the future. So again, it's an issue that has been a concern of mine going back a couple of years. Certainly was brought up again when I saw the language in the contract that proposed to preclude RCA from acting in that role again. And the suggestion in the contract is that even if RCA did somehow act in its regulatory role and caused an impact to the companies, that the state would somehow indemnify for that action. And of course, I'm not sure I can think of any time that the RCA would really enter into that where it wouldn't be to mitigate the effect of a tariff that they thought was too high. And of course, a tariff being too high gets subtracted from our wellhead value. And so it would seem to me that the RCA would be doing exactly what we would want them to do, try and maintain a lower tariff that's to the benefit of the consumer and to the benefit of the state of Alaska. So
your intent is not to set up dueling regulatory agencies, but to look for a successor in the case that FERC goes away?
If FERC goes away, or if there's a portion of the operation that FERC determines it doesn't fall into their jurisdiction, somebody could make the claim that, well, it should be regulated by RCA, because there may be parts of the overall operation that might not be real clear that FERC is going to regulate at all.
Mr. Shepler, could we borrow you for a moment?
Yes, sir.
And we also do, is Mr. Leffler still online? We'll hold on to him, but just to make sure. Mr. Shepler, what chance is there that FERC will dissolve with no successor?
Bob Leffler just stepped out. We'll get him back.
Thank you.
I haven't thought very much about that. Certainly, the FERC is a federal institution. It dates from essentially 1938 in various succession, in various forms. Certainly nothing prohibits the Congress from amending the Natural Gas Act, which is the source of the FERC's power over this pipeline system. You're talking about something that is going for another 50 years. It's conceivable. I guess I wouldn't say that it is very high probability, but I think the issue that is more problematic is the issue of some pieces of this system not ultimately being found to be subject to the FERC's jurisdiction. There's the pipeline, which I think everyone agrees would be subject to FERC regulation. There's the treatment plant, which may or may not be, probably, in my opinion, would be regulated. But then there are the upstream so-called feeder lines or gas transmission lines, and there's the NGL plant. Unclear whether the further upstream you go that the FERC is going to assert jurisdiction or be affirmed in that jurisdiction. So there is that dimension to the problem that maybe not all of the system being contemplated here would ultimately be regulated by the FERC.
So would the RCA have regulatory authority outside of the boundaries of the state of Alaska?
I wouldn't think so, sir.
Just intrastate.
I have not thought about this, but I would think that's probably correct.
So if FERC were just to all of a sudden go away and there was no successor, Senator Theriault is, it appears to me, attempting to preserve the right for the RCA to step in as a regulatory agency in terms of tariff. Is that correct,
but
Senator Theriault?
The RCA has its own statutory regulatory authority.
Right. But we're not trying to set up dueling on the mainline pipe, but there can be questions, like you said, spur lines probably will not be FERC regulated. That would come down to Anchorage. So that would be an RCA authority. Is that correct?
It could be.
Could be. So areas that FERC doesn't assert authority, is what we're looking at?
Where the FERC would either not assert authority or not be found to have authority.
Not found to have authority.
Now, certainly a takeaway line, a delivery line, an intrastate delivery line off taking gas off of the main line to Fairbanks or Anchorage,
right,
would certainly, under the federal statutes that now exist, would be RCA jurisdictional.
So I guess I guess I'm just trying to get to, because the way I read this, I have a question, because first, before we could diminish the legal authority, we would have to define what that authority was. So there'd have to be some definition of what the authority of the RCA was before it could be diminished. Or it could be indemnified from those decisions. But the way this reads, it basically could possibly set up dueling authority if we're not careful. I don't know. Maybe not. I just want to make sure we don't. Senator Bundy.
In going in over my depth as a FERC attorney, this would seem to me, as we, I think, have seen in ample instances as we've gone through these discussions, there will always be some gray areas where not quite FERC-y, but not quite RCA either. And this would seem a little bit belt and suspenders that focuses on the possible gray areas and preclude any opportunity of someone to try to escape regulation by either entity.
Is Mr. Leffler online yet?
I'm here now.
Mr. Leffler, are you familiar with the amendment?
I am not. Well, it's just been written down. I'll have to take a second to look at it.
Well, the amendment basically provides that nothing in a contract under this chapter diminishes the legal authority of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska or indemnifies any person or entity from future decisions of the Regulatory Commission of Alaska or a successor to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Comments?
Let me address the amendment, but yes, Mr. Scheffler did address a few of the questions that have been asked. The intent of the contract provision on the RCA was to draw clear lines. It's part of the overall effort to get fiscal certainty. And at least in my mind, there was no intent to change jurisdiction, but to establish clearly where the federal jurisdiction was. And conversely, as Mr. Scheffler referenced, when we worked on the legislation to make sure the RCA had jurisdiction over the lateral. So from the get-go, that's the overall design, and I believe that it corresponds, at least in my understanding of the facts, to federal law, and federal law would, on this project, include the main line, the GTP, and I believe the upstream feeder lines, which would not be making deliveries in Alaska, but would be feeding it into an interstate pipeline and part of an interstate transmission system. That's point number one. Point number two is that the question has been asked, what happens if the FERC goes away? I agree with Mr. Scheffler that FERC's been in business since 1938 through itself or a predecessor. I believe that's a remote possibility. And the question you then get into, which is a federal constitutional question, is whether when the federal government has the authority to regulate an area, if it changes the form of regulation, does that open up the area for regulation by the state? And I think in the electric area, the Narragansett case suggests that the states cannot step in and regulate interstate commerce, even if the federal government has not acted to regulate that area. So in the hypothetical and remote case, where the FERC, the Congress decides the FERC should have a different form of regulation or not regulate a part of the interstate gas business, I can't give you an opinion that the state could step in.
But anyway, the question then becomes the language of the amendment, and it's, and I'm now going to look at it. Nothing in a contract under this chapter diminishes the legal authority of the RCA or indemnifies any person or entity from future decisions of the RCA or a successor to the RCA. As to the second half, the second independent clause, in the indemnity, yes, the contract does contain a possible indemnification with a lot of hurdles and limitations before you get to it. So from the point of view of the administration, we couldn't agree to that consistent with the tentative contract that we put before you or will put before you. I want to emphasize, as I did in Juneau, that there are limitations on loss that apply to the indemnification clause as well as any other loss under the contract that remove the highest exposure or largest potential exposure if they ever got to an actual loss situation. So we don't agree, as far as I know, with the indemnity language in the amendment because it's inconsistent with what we've negotiated. I don't know what the first sentence, the first half of the sentence really does. It states a truism, I guess. If the RCA doesn't have jurisdiction, it's not changed, and if it does, it's not changed. It seems a self-evident statement, but that's the best I can do.
Thank you, Mr. Leffner. Questions? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It just seems odd that this is targeted to go under Section 4382-200, which is contract development, and it doesn't seem to fit that well. I'm wondering why it wasn't proposed to go under Regulations 4382-610.
Senator Terrio.
Mr. Chairman, I asked the drafter, I wrote this language up last night and faxed over late last night or early this morning, asked him to tell me where it would fit in the statute, because what I want to do is direct that the power of the RCA to utilize its statutory power would not be precluded in the contract. And I guess I'm wondering if Mr. Loeffler could give us an example of the RCA exercising its power that would need to be indemnified for in the contract. Because I guess just looking at the RCA regulating this transportation system or the feeder lines coming into it, they would do so to make sure the tariff is not too high. And so I'm wondering if that's in fact what the current contractual language tries to indemnify in case RCA does make that determination in the future, because if they do, I think it's to the benefit of the consumers and it's to the benefit of the state of Alaska, because the tariff, of course, gets subtracted away from our wellhead value.
Let me address that hypothetical. If the RCA attempted to set the tariff on the feeder lines and they were subject to regulation by the federal government, that exercise would be preempted. So no loss would arrive. The RCA could not, on the assumption they're regulated by the federal government, the RCA could just not set a different tariff. In Juneau, I explained the difference between the oil line and the gas line on that, and I can come back to that if necessary. Now, if the RCA, if the federal government did not, if somehow we're in the situation where the federal government does not, contrary to my understanding, regulate the tariff of a feeder line into the interstate system, and the RCA has jurisdiction, if the RCA said the profit element was too high on the feeder line, then the contract kicks in, and there cannot be, under my view of the contract, an indemnity for those lost profits. If you'll give me 1 second, I'll read you the part of the contract that applies. at 37.2, the state and participants have negotiated this contract in consideration of their consent to limit recovery of certain loss. Accordingly, in no event is any party liable to any other party for the following loss that arise or out of or relate to this contract or any breach of it. Any consequential or incidental damages, including lost profits. So if the RCA said the tariffs were too high because the profit element is too high, and that's the normal way a tariff is attacked, the way I read all the provisions of the contract together, in a dispute, after you go through other procedural hurdles, you cannot get lost profits from the state. You can't be indemnified for that because we've limited the indemnity. So the question I think you would next ask is, well, what does this language mean in the indemnity clause? Where is the situation where there might be an indemnity? The only one I could think of is that the RCA would attempt to impose contract carriage on a feeder line, displacing or attempting to displace existing shippers in favor of new shippers. And so the displaced shipper might argue that it had suffered a loss. But whether it had really suffered a loss depends a lot on the facts downstream, whether it was really advantaged by having not to ship at a particular time. Depends on its contracts. It depends on its ability to cover those contracts downstream. And it assumes further that an attempt to impose contract carriage on a flow of gas into an interstate pipeline that depends on that flow is not also an interference with the operation of that pipeline. So I apologize for the length of my answer, but I've tried to answer both the question that you asked and the question that follows.
Thank you, Mr. Loeffler. Mr. Shepler.
Mr. Chairman, listening to Mr. Loeffler and his reference to the 2004 federal legislation, raises an interesting situation in my mind, or suggests a circumstance that maybe hasn't been discussed here, and that is that in the 2004 legislation, Congress established specific rules over federal regulation of an Alaskan pipeline project. Congress can act again in the future and make rules with respect to federal regulation of an Alaskan pipeline project that would have absolutely nothing to do with the regulation that the FERC has had for the last 70 years in the lower 48. So, you know, there is a scenario where Congress could act in future legislation that would be surgical in nature, focused on deregulating perhaps the federal regulation of the Alaskan pipeline project or some portions of that project, just as there was surgical legislation that gave the FERC certain powers and certain obligations with respect to that Alaskan pipeline project. You know, it's what goes around comes around scenario that does not depend on massive deregulation or abolition of the FERC.
May I comment on that?
Mr. Loeffler, go ahead.
I would say, under the Commerce Clause, the federal government, through the Congress, chooses how to regulate entity, and its choice of the form of regulation doesn't mean that someone can step in and fill the gap. So if the federal government has decided, for whatever reason, that the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline should be regulated through a rate ceiling methodology, as it once did with oil pipelines, that does not give leeway for the state to step in and say, well, you've changed the form of regulation, but you know, we don't agree with your form of regulation, so we'll put our own in. It's the federal government's province to decide how to regulate. So the fact that it can change surgically an element of regulation does not remove that from federal jurisdiction.
Okay, Senator Terrio.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just I'm always a little bit leery when we take comfort in the, you know, the protection that's afforded to us by another government. Of course, we're the state of Alaska, and we have the RCA that that we control, and so it wouldn't be subject, to whether the Congress tweaks the language or abolish the agency. Again, if we enter into a contract for a very long time. In 8.3, I use the term indemnification, but in section 8.3 of the contract, it talks about if it results in a loss to a participant, the state shall reimburse the participant for a loss, which reimbursement could include costs to cover transportation or other appropriate relief. So I was just concerned that, you know, we set up a regulatory agency. It can't duplicate the federal agency. So we don't set up a dueling situation of is it the feds or is it the states. But if there's a section of the line that, as Mr. Scheffler indicated, maybe doesn't fall under FERC jurisdiction, but would fall under RCA, the regular RCA powers, wouldn't we want that agency to continue to exercise those powers? If in the exercising of its powers to protect the consumer, to protect the state, you know, it caused a loss, would we want to have to reimburse for that? If they made a decision somewhere down the road 10 or 15 years from now and the legislature at that time disagreed with that, they could modify the powers of the RCA at that time. But at this point, we don't know that far in advance whether that happens. So, you know, I asked the drafters to write this up just to not increase the RCA's powers, not to cause any overlap, but just to preserve them as they are under law established by the legislature.
So if I could understand this, Mr. Senator Terrio, nothing in a contract under this chapter diminishes the legal authority of the RCA regarding areas of RCA authority, or indemnifies any person or entity from future decisions of the RCA or its successor to the RCA regarding decisions made under RCA's existing authority.
That's right. So we would be giving instruction to the administration that is something that we would rather not see.
Would it be better then that we clarify in the amendment that we're only talking about areas or decisions regarding areas that are under the RCA authority?
That would be fine. Of course, they can't regulate anything that's not under their
authority. I understand. Just reads better for the layman sometimes. Since we understand that, why not say it?
If you've got some suggestion of clarifying language.
I would just suggest conceptually here that nothing in a contract under this chapter diminishes the legal authority of the RCA regarding areas under RCA authority, or indemnifies any person or entity from future decisions of the RCA or a successor to the RCA regarding areas under RCA authority or decisions under RCA authority.
Mr. Chairman, I think
made under
I think that still encapsulates my intent.
Comment, Mr. Leffler?
2 points. On the first half of it, which is really what I view as a restatement of existing law, I would reference existing law, which is 4206-245. The requirements of this chapter pertaining to permits and certificates, public convenience and necessity, do not apply to the construction of a pipeline exclusively subject to federal jurisdiction or to the interstate portion of that business. So the first half of it, I won't agree with. It's sort of a truism.
So it's just a restatement of a truism.
Yeah. The second part, and this is a legitimate public policy issue, is recognizing that we have put in limits on the reimbursement. Senator Terrio is correct. And there are a set of procedural hurdles even before you get to the possibility of reimbursement for a loss, if you can construct a loss other than lost profits. I feel constrained as a representative of the administration not to agree with, because it's contrary to the negotiations that occurred on the draft contract.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Stedman.
I'm still kind of confused, Mr. Chairman, on the words being inserted, and maybe I just didn't understand the answer. Because it's referring to wanting to put this amendment in under contract development, and there appears to be, under Article 7, a section for regulation. Why wouldn't it be in regulation versus in contract development? Why would it be under 82-200 instead of 82-610?
Mr. Chairman, I think because when I spoke to the drafter, I told him that, you know, we want to direct the administration as they develop the contract that this impact on RCA is not something that they will do. And so he suggested that it belonged in that section. Under the construction of the contract, this would be instruction to the administration to not impact RCA's powers as you construct the contract.
Go ahead, Senator Stebbin.
Can you identify any diminishment within the contract of RCA's authority? I don't have any.
Well, and I think that's why Mr. Shepler said that that's sort of a restatement of a, you know, the current, and the real operative part, I guess, is where they get to the indemnification or the reimbursement that might be triggered from RCA actually taking on its statutory role. And I'm not sure if we have our state regulatory agency doing what our statutes instruct it to do, why we would want to indemnify or reimburse for a resulting loss if, in fact, it's dealing with, you know, tariffs, making sure the tariffs are not too high or people have access to lines.
Senator Green.
Senator Terrio, do you remember, or maybe Mr. Leffler might remember, who in the presentation at Centennial Hall presented that information? Was that Mr. Leffler?
Yes, it was. I was there, and I spoke to this subject.
Okay, because I kind of remember the conversation. And what was your, for instance, or a site of an incident at which the indemnification over RCA's action might take place? Did you use the word overstepping?
I believe I could have.
Could you give us a for instance at which, under this, what we hope are the regular circumstances, and FERC oversees all that pipeline and RCA does intrastate and utilities, what is something they might do that would cause a dispute, that would cause litigation? Because as I recall, that's what you were talking about, was a period of time where there might be a dispute.
Well, here's a couple things that might happen. if you look at 4206240, that requires a North Slope natural gas pipeline to apply for a certificate, except it also says the requirement for a certificate does not operate to impose state regulation that has been preempted under federal law. So it's difficult to understand what's going on in the statute. If the RCA asked the applicant for the main line to apply for a certificate of public convenience and necessity under state law, and to address as part of that application how much service will be intrastate service, it's my opinion that's inconsistent with the requirements of the federal statute, which requires a certificate of public convenience and necessity. So you could have the RCA sort of stepping into the jurisdiction of the FERC, which looks at gas markets and potential gas shippers and is required to look at how much gas will, or how much transportation capacity will be set aside for intrastate uses. And so you could have dueling agencies. You could have the RCA saying, well, we have a view on how much transportation capacity should be set aside, and we're going to try and use our authority to do that. And you could have the federal government saying, no, no, it's our business. And I think under the Lavaca case and other cases like that, it is the federal government's business. And what you would have is then a jurisdictional fight. And the idea of 8.3 was to, before anyone starts claiming a dispute or a loss, to have a cooling off period where the state and federal governments could talk and clarify any jurisdictional issue before you get to dispute resolution and a claim for loss. That's an example I can construct out of the language of the statute as it reads, the RCA statute.
May I answer the question?
Go ahead, Senator Green.
Well, would this proposed amendment then keep, as the contract currently proposes, then the state would assist in indemnifying the producers or the other partners for actions of the state's RCA. Is that correct?
If the RCA caused this magic term a loss to the producers, and there are sideboards and limitations and on the loss, but this amendment would prevent the state, if a loss were adjudicated and proved, this amendment would prevent the state from reimbursing for that loss.
Thank you.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at 8.3 in light of what Mr. Leffler has said. And the second sentence on page 87 of the contract starts off, it says, if the FERC does not assert jurisdiction, no party may seek or support jurisdiction of the RCA, et cetera. And so I'm having trouble getting back to Mr. Leffler's point that somehow we're talking about a constitutional crisis here between state and federal regulation. The contract itself is triggered if the FERC does not assert jurisdiction. So if the FERC determines that it is not its job, it doesn't have authority, or it's not its authority to regulate some part of this system, then the contract goes on that no party, including, and I think party includes the state, may seek or support the jurisdiction of the RCA. And I believe that all that Senator Terrio's proposed amendment does is say that, in so many words, that nothing in the contract diminishes whatever authority the RCA might have in that circumstance as set forth in its statutory mandate. So there is the contemplation in the contract is that the FERC would not assert jurisdiction as the triggering event, and I believe that subject to confirmation of the author here, that the intent is to leave it, make it very clear that there's no change being made by this contract to whatever the authority of the RCA is under its existing charter.
Senator Green.
Yeah, well, I would suggest, though, that the real thrust of this is the R indemnifies any person or entity from future decisions of the RCA.
Okay.
Senator Green, that...
And that to me goes to the, you know, provision in the contract.
Well, that's regard to the loss part, but as Mr. Shepler read, you know, the contract does say if FERC does not assert jurisdiction, no party, so that means even the state could not go to FERC and or RCA and say, well, FERC has pulled out, said they're not going to cover this. Your statute, the RCA's language, says the requirements of this chapter pertain to permits, certificates of public convenience and necessity, do not apply to construction of pipeline facility exclusively subject to federal jurisdiction. So if the federal jurisdiction there is, RCA is precluded.
Okay.
However, if FERC says, oh, we're not going to regulate, I just wanted to preserve the right of RCA to say, well, now we're just going to follow our statutes, our direction from the legislature, to step in and see if we have jurisdiction over that, because we've set the RCA up for the purpose of protecting the state and the consumers.
May I make one clarifying point?
Go right ahead, Mr. Leffler.
This language does not restrict the RCA in that remote circumstance from stepping in. The RCA is excluded from the definition of the state as an independent regulatory agency. So, in the hypothetical, if the RCA asserts jurisdiction, this language does not restrict the RCA. There's nothing in the contract that restricts the RCA from asserting lawful jurisdiction in that circumstance.
Senator Terrio?
A question for Mr. Leffler. But would it restrict the state from requesting that the RCA assert its jurisdiction according to the law of Alaska? The state would not be able to advocate for that.
The state would not be able to advocate for that, but we all know that there's an abundance of interested parties, as we've seen in all the RCA and FERC litigation who come in. But the state itself, by this language, could not ask for RCA jurisdiction.
And so, Mr. Chairman, we could have the strange situation where the state, as a, you know, a being, has written its laws to direct RCA, believes the law should be exercised, but would be precluded from saying so. Would be precluded from encouraging the RCA to use the state law.
And if I understand 4206-245, that nothing limits the power of the commission set out in this chapter except to the extent they are preempted by federal law. That's existing law. Doesn't that cover this? You can't contract it away. The statute says nothing limits the powers of the commission except to the extent they are preempted by federal law. Wouldn't that cover these circumstances we're talking about here?
But if you had a situation where maybe the RCA does want to assert its jurisdiction.
Unless it's preempted by federal law, it can exert its jurisdiction.
Okay. But the state of Alaska, the one that wrote the law for the RCA, wouldn't be able to say, you're right, would not be able to support that activity, even if it's in the state's best interest. contract by the terms of the contract, the state of Alaska would be precluded from doing that, even if it believes it's in its best interest.
And it'd just be good to say that nothing in this contract preempts the requirements of 4206-245?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow that.
Nothing in the contract under this chapter supersedes the requirements of section 4206-245, which basically says nothing limits the powers of the commissions except to the extent they're preempted by federal law.
Mr. Chairman, I think that probably does get us there. I don't want to rely on Pioneer having to protect the state in the future.
I understand that.
Then you still have your indemnification.
But so I think that reference to 245 and coupled with the indemnification probably again encapsulates what I'm trying to get to.
Okay, where do we want to go? We've looked at it, and where do we want to go with it?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, how many angels are dancing on the head of this?
Yeah.
I'll object.
Okay, there is objection.
Or was it objected to?
Okay. Senator, there is objection. Is there further discussion? Senator Elton.
Just for clarification's sake, Mr. Chair, you had talked about a friendly amendment. There was a dialogue between you and the amendment sponsor, and I don't remember whether or not the special committee codified what your intent was or not, or has the amendment before us been changed in any way? You had offered a conceptual amendment.
I talked about it, but I didn't offer it. I would. It is a restatement of a truism that already exists. The first part of it. But is the second part of it also somewhat of a truism, or is it introducing new law that says you can preempt federal law as long as you do it this way? I mean, the indemnification side of it.
But Mr. Chair.
Senator Green.
There's the other point, too, though, that Senator Terrio quoted from, I think it's provision 83, that is a part of the contract that very clearly states the state will indemnify the operators or the partners for any actions by RCA that causes a loss or diminishment or whatever it is. And so that consideration has to be given. Is that what we think is right? Because this not only allegedly, protects RCA, but also says the state will not indemnify any other person. I don't know what the toll thing is, that the reasoning is for indemnifying the others, but it was because it was a state agency.
Someone explain to Senator Green why indemnification is necessary in the contract. Luann?
I would suggest that Mr.
Leffler
might
Mr. Leffler?
I will try. The precise language is if the RCA asserts jurisdiction and takes actions inconsistent with principles of FERC policy, for jurisdictional facilities or the commercial agreements that result in a loss, the state shall reimburse the participant for loss. I want to get that clearly in mind, that it's just not automatic, that it's got to be FERC regulation RCA regulation that's inconsistent with FERC principles or commercial agreements. The rationale was that the same rationale you'll hear us say over and over again, that they wanted clarity as to the regulatory arrangement. They did not want to, at a later day, be faced with a change in those arrangements that caused them an unanticipated loss. And the state, the RCA is a creature of state law, and so when you look at the allocation of risk between the companies and the state, that the state should be responsible within the limitations and hurdles and procedures and before any loss that ultimately results from actions taken by the RCA inconsistent with those standards. And about all I can add to that is what I think I said at Centennial Hall. The decision, some of the companies pressed very hard for that. And the decision, the negotiation session at which this was agreed to involve some other economic trades, and those who were there felt that that was a fair trade.
Okay. Senator Green, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's RCA's actions inconsistent with FERC principles. That's the key to the language in, you know, number 83 and provision 83, and probably for good reason.
So you would suggest saying, adding to the end of the paragraph, that are inconsistent with
unless RCA's
federal regulations
were inconsistent with FERC principles.
Federal regulations is probably the easy way. I don't know. What do you think, Mr. Shepler?
Motion.
I was trying to get Senator Green's language down.
Basically, at the end of the paragraph, or future decisions of the RCA or a successor of the RCA that are inconsistent with federal law or FERC regulation. That appears to be what we're after.
So we're saying, or successor to the RCA, if such actions are inconsistent with federal law or regulation.
Did you say FERC or federal?
Federal.
Which is FERC, federal law or federal regulation.
I
just didn't hear what you said.
Does that fit within your intent, Senator Terrio?
Well, I guess, Mr. Chairman, I was thinking that if the RCA is exercising its power, which we have granted to it, not that it's consistent with, you know, the federal, you know, what Congress wants to do, but we have granted it certain power. And if it exercises that power for the protection of the state and the consumers, why would we want to indemnify because a loss was incurred?
May I try?
If they're preempted by federal law, you can't exercise the power.
Right. If they're preempted by federal law, they're going to have no jurisdiction. But if there is no federal jurisdiction and the RCA asserts jurisdiction, and they utilize, again, the power, statutory power we have granted to them, and it causes a loss, why would
then
we?
And why do we have this sentence in there?
Pardon?
If it's inconsistent with federal law, why do we even have that sentence in there? Why do we have indemnification against something that's inconsistent with federal law? I mean, I don't understand.
Well, it's,
or
if we're applying our law, if the RCA, which is a creature of our creation, exercises the power that we've given it, just because it runs counter to a FERC principle, why would we indemnify for that? And I think that the smaller players in the state of Alaska probably, you know, do see some protection from RCA if, in fact, there's a piece of infrastructure that is not covered by federal authority. And if they choose to exercise that to get protection for themselves and the state, I don't know why we would pick up any loss out of it. They're just exercising the power that we gave them.
Well, I understand that, but I guess I'm not willing to say you can't be indemnified against something that's contrary to federal law. I mean, if a decision then is, I mean, if a decision came down from the RCA and said this is it, and that it was later shown that that decision was preempted by federal law, I guess I have a problem with that. But
well, Mr. Chairman, I think federal law and a principle of FERC are probably two different things.
Well,
clearly, the RCA can't operate contrary to federal law.
Nothing limits the powers of the commission except to the extent they are preempted by federal law under existing law today. So it would seem to me that if, and maybe I'm arguing around the circle, but it seems to me that if something's preempted by federal law, it's not enforceable. So why are we bothering to indemnify against something that's not enforceable?
I don't think that's the situation, Senator. I think that
okay.
the provision of 8.3 contemplates a circumstance where FERC does not assert jurisdiction.
All right.
Okay, so you have the FERC has stepped aside or doesn't have the authority to go there in the first place. And your own state statute would say that the RCA, in the absence of FERC federal authority, the RCA has such authority.
Yes.
And if in exercising that authority, it requires a party to make a refund or charge a lower rate, the question comes back as to whether the state ought to be reimbursing the entity that was overcharging for having to roll back its rate. I think that's the policy question that
okay.
Senator Terrio is raising of the anomaly here where you have a state agency exercising its authority, implicitly finding that someone has been overcharged, and then the state treasury somehow having to come back and reimburse the overcharging party for some or all of the overcharge.
Senator Green.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think in the conversation at Centennial Hall, I also remember them talking about the fact that because the contract was based on the premise that it would be FERC controlled, everyone was considering FERC regulations, principles, rules, et cetera, as the basis for the contract. And they were not considering anything by RCA being a part of it. And I just seemed like I remember that as part of the presentation. And as the reason that was even included. I don't know if that helps or not. But
well, we know, Mr.
The indemnification.
Mr. Chairman, from the struggle that we had a couple of years back, all the producers in the state of Alaska, you know, they look at RCA and the protection the RCA potentially offers to them differently. We had quite a struggle about 3 or 4 years ago where the power of RCA was, there was a request to restrict it. And the smaller entities in the state saw that was, you know, a state entity that offered them some protection with regards to rates that are charged and access. And it just seems to me like, you know, we want to preserve that power. And if, in fact, they find somewhere that somebody's charging a rate that's too high and they have to lower that rate, we shouldn't have to reimburse out of the state treasury for the RCA, our regulatory body, finding that tariff was too high.
Okay.
Excuse me, but
go ahead, Mr. Leffler.
The one I keep trying to work within the confines of the structure that, yes, there's reimbursement, but if the tariff is too high, as the RCA found it was in the TAPS case, because the profit element is too high, we're not required, under the language I read to everyone, to reimburse for lost profits. So what I'm trying to carefully say is there is some limited reimbursement or indemnification possible. But when you work through the language of the section and the operative limitations in the contract, I believe it's quite remote and limited. And so I'm objecting a little bit to hypotheticals that don't fit within the language of the contract.
Okay, other questions? Seeing none, is the objection maintained?
Yes.
Objection is maintained. Call the roll, clerk.
Senator Stanton?
No.
Senator Bundy?
No.
Senator Kukesh?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
No.
Senator Olson?
Yes.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Yes.
Senator
Elton?
Yes.
Senator Hoffman?
No.
Senator Green?
No.
Senator Wagner?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
No.
Six yea, six nay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator, I would look at the amendment a little bit differently if we could clear up that language on what is indemnified.
Thank you.
So if you want to, I'd say go ahead and look at that. Senator Terrio. Other amendments to be brought to the committee? Seeing none, discussion on Senate Bill 2004. Senator Bundy.
Mr. Chairman, knowing this bill is, like a lot of legislation we do, a work in progress, I think we've gone about as far as we can go at this point until we have further information. So if you're ready for a motion, I'd move that this bill be...
Before we do that, can I just ask clerk one more time, did we dispose of 5B?
Yes.
It is disposed of on the record. Remains on the table. Thank you. Senator?
I would move that we move 2004 from committee as amended with individual recommendations and eagerly awaited opportunity to look at the issues again.
And the attached fiscal note.
Yes.
Is there objection? Hearing no objection.
Object.
Would you like to speak to your objection, Senator
no.
Elton?
No, that's fine. Thank you for the
clerk,
opportunity.
Please call the roll.
Senator Kukesh?
Yes.
Senator Stevens?
Yes.
Senator Stedman?
Yes.
Senator Bundy?
Yes.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Dyson?
Yes.
Senator Wilkins?
Yes.
Senator Elton?
No.
Yes. Senator Green?
Yes.
Senator Wagner?
Yes.
Senator Seekins?
Yes. Does anyone wish to change their vote? Senator Olson?
I'll go from no to yay.
Senator Olson goes from no to yay. Anyone else? Clerk, please tally the roll.
11 yay, 1 nay.
And so Senate Bill 2004 has moved to the next committee of referral, which is Rules Committee. Is there any other matter to come before the committee today? Senator Elton.
Just a matter of the uniform rules. It's my understanding that any bill with fiscal note has to be referred to finance, and I wonder if anybody has, I can't recall what the rule is, but
I think this
what
is
the
zero.
Rule number is.
Senator Stevens.
Mr. Chairman, as the presiding officer, I've made a ruling that this is the Finance Committee. It's a combination of Resources and Finance Committee, and this satisfies that referral.
And Senator Elton, I believe that it is a zero fiscal note. So I don't think it would have to, under normal rules, even without the ruling of the President of the Senate, have to be referred to a Finance Committee. With that, once again, let's look at the calendar. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, it was my understanding that we were going to have roundtable discussions within the next couple of days on this bill.
We will have roundtable discussions on the on the concept behind the bill and of the entire process having to do with natural gas development. We anticipate that we'll see this type of bill or a similar bill in a future special session as well. But I think we have done good work on this particular bill, and now what we want to take a look at is the opportunity to discuss the recommendations and reports that are brought to us by the consultants, and also to be able to have a roundtable discussion on the general process and the general topic of natural gas development on Wednesday. Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, I don't understand what the roundtable discussions are going to do if we've already passed the bill out of committee.
This bill is passed out of committee. You're correct, Senator Olson. I don't believe the topic has come to an end. We have 2003 open, and we still have consideration for discussion having to do with the general topic of the natural gas contract and provisions in that contract for an open forum for members to be able to discuss. And that's what the intent is. So it's not to rehash the provisions of this bill, but to talk about the general topic and to receive the opportunity for our members to be able to ask questions of the consultants that they have addressed in their work and that they may not have addressed in their work, and then also on the roundtable to be able to include in that producers and administration and members of the legislature to give them the opportunity for that conversation to take place in a roundtable discussion. So it's not to rehash this bill. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I agree with the remarks of the chair. I'll just remind Senator Olson that we stripped out a section here on the collateral relationships with the anticipation that it'll probably show up in the other legislation having to do with the LLC and so on. And there were a half a dozen conversations came up here that we need more information on as we go on in this process, and I'm looking forward to those discussions being very profitable.
In addition, I know I am eager to pursue the relationship between the RCA and FERC, and need more time to be able to consider what effect that indemnification may have, Senator Olson. So
eager?
Eager.
Very eager.
Very eager, Senator Hoffman. Other questions? Once again, I went through the calendar for the next 2 days, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. Then the roundtable will take place shortly after the floor session on Wednesday. Any other questions from the members? If not, thank you, Senator Stevens.
For the record, for members as well as for members that aren't present at the committee, when we send the packet to drafters, I'll call and get an estimate on the time it will take. We anticipate bringing this bill and read across tonight.
Okay.
Get the notice out when that will be as soon as possible. Thank you.
And please don't leave the room until we got back. Are we back with the bill?
It's working its way around.
It's working its way around. Make sure you sign the bill before you leave the committee room. And with that, it's now 10 minutes after the hour of 3 p.m., and the committee is adjourned for the day.
That's a full day's work, isn't it?
Yes.